The sound of this doorbell may seem pretty ordinary to you, until you realize that it's Graham, who's 75 years old and still delivering meals to people in need in his neighborhood. And that for many of them, it's the most comforting sound they'll hear all day. Seniors bring so much to Quebec. Let's recognize their contribution. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. In this episode, Mondo Weiss's U.S. correspondent Michael Aria updates us on some key stories he is tracking in his weekly politics newsletter, The Shift. After that, Michael speaks to Zoha Khalili, a staff attorney at Palestine Legal, about the organization's 2021 year-in-review report. Michael, the top story in last week's Shift newsletter was the death of Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State and the first woman to ever hold that position.
Yeah, Madeleine Albright died recently. She was, of course, Bill Clinton's Secretary of State from 97 until 2001. She was the first woman to ever hold that position. There's been a couple since her. And before that, from the first half of his presidency, she was the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. In the newsletter, I covered something she said, which has, I think, a really interesting legacy. A lot of people were bringing it up on social media after she passed away. There was a very famous 60 Minutes segment in spring of 1996, where CBS took a hard, kind of concise look at the impact of the Clinton administration's sanctions on Iraq. Particularly the impact that they were having on children in the country. And at that time, there was a UN commission study that found estimated up to perhaps 500,000 Iraqi children had died as a result of those sanctions. So Leslie Stahl, the host of 60 Minutes, or one of the correspondents, asked Albright pretty directly if she thought that the price was worth it.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it. It is a moral question, but the moral question is even a larger one. Don't we owe to the American people and to the American military and to the other countries in the region that this man not be a threat?
In the newsletter, I just kind of talked about the legacy of those remarks because they weren't really referenced in U.S. media much after the fact, but you know, they obviously made the rounds in other parts of the world, particularly the Middle East, where lots of people were aware of those comments. And people might remember that shortly after September 11th, bin Laden actually referenced, I think it was less than a month after, put out a video in which he referenced Iraqi children dying from the sanctions. I mean, that was a consistent staple of his recruitment videos and others. So they really had this kind of legacy that wasn't really reflected in the U.S. media at all. I found a FAIR piece from November 2001 when I wrote the newsletter, which took a look in the wake of September 11th, how many times that 60 Minutes interview had been referenced. And the author of the piece was only able to find one op-ed, I believe, in the Orange County Register that mentioned it. So I talked about that. And I also talked about this moment later in the presidency, at which point I believe she was already Secretary of State, where her and a bunch of other Clinton or a couple other Clinton administration figures showed up at Ohio State University to make a case really for confrontation with Saddam Hussein. And this is something that I think her death should kind of highlight for people that, you know, some people might view the Clinton years as kind of this gap between the Gulf War and, you know, the second Bush's war in Iraq. But in actuality, if you look at the Clinton years, of course, you know, they continually bombed Iraq. There were these sanctions which killed thousands of people. And they also, you know, developed this policy for attacking Iraq. They passed or Clinton signed legislation that basically made regime change policy official. This is, you know, years before the Bush administration. So a lot of the groundwork for what happens under Bush and the attack on Iraq and the invasion is, you know, those seeds are really planted during the Clinton years. So anyway, she was confronted at this event, which aired on CNN. And, you know, this is before everybody had like a camera in their back pocket. So it's kind of hard to, you know, you just didn't see stuff like this much, especially on national television where politicians had to field like really difficult questions. So there's a 22-year-old substitute teacher at the time, a guy named John Strange, who gets up and basically asks, to paraphrase, just asks Albright directly.
Yes, I have a question for Secretary Albright. Why bomb Iraq when other countries have committed similar violations? Turkey, for example. Can I finish? For example, Turkey has bombed Kurdish citizens. Saudi Arabia has tortured political and religious dissidents. Why does the U.S. apply different standards of justice to these countries?
Let me say that when there are problems such as you have described, we point them out and make very clear our opposition to them. But there is no one that has done to his people or to his neighbors what Saddam Hussein has done or what he is thinking about.
Indonesia. Well, you've turned my microphone off.
That Saddam Hussein has produced weapons of mass destruction, which he's clearly not collecting for his own personal pleasure, but in order to use, and therefore he is qualitatively and quantitatively different from every brutal dictator that has appeared recently. And we are very concerned about him specifically and what his plans might be.
Thank you. What, my microphone is off, there we are. What do you have to say about dictators of countries like Indonesia, who we sell weapons to, yet they are slaughtering people in East Timor? What do you have to say about Israel, who is slaughtering Palestinians, who impose martial law? What do you have to say about that? Those are our allies. Why do we sell weapons to these countries? Why do we support them? Why do we bomb Iraq when it commits similar problems?
There are various examples of things that are not right in this world, and the United States is trying surprised that people feel that it is necessary to defend the rights of Saddam Hussein, when what we ought to be thinking about is how to make sure that he does not use weapons of mass destruction.
I'm not defending him in the least. What I am saying is that there needs to be consistent application of U.S. foreign policy. We cannot support people who are committing the same violations because they are political allies. That is not acceptable. We cannot violate U.N. resolutions when it is convenient to us. You're not answering my question, Madam Albright.
Study carefully what American foreign policy is, what we have said exactly about the cases that you have mentioned. Every one of them have been pointed out. Every one of them we have clearly stated our policy on. And if you would like, as a former professor, I would be delighted to spend 50 minutes with you describing exactly what we are doing on those subjects.
Secretary.
It's all the beats that we'd see years later, which kind of became associated with the Bush administration, of course. You know, these words like regime change, these allegations of weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be completely false. And, you know, that old bit that the Bush administration loved to roll out, which is, you know, if you oppose the war on terror, obviously you're not patriotic or you're defending Saddam Hussein. So, you know, there was a lot of laudatory press, obviously, when she died, as these things generally go, and a lot of op-eds kind of celebrating her. And of course, she was a historic figure in many ways, but that part of her legacy obviously wasn't really covered in the mainstream media at all. So, yeah, the first part of the newsletter last week was about that.
You pointed out on Twitter that the person putting those hard questions to Albright at the Ohio State event was John Strange, a former writer at the magazine Punk Planet.
Oh, yeah. Shout out to Punk Planet.
We'll include a link to the Punk Planet archives in the show notes for those listeners who aren't familiar with that legendary magazine. The Middle East Studies Association overwhelmingly passed a BDS resolution recently. Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. This is, for people who don't know the Middle East Association, I believe they've existed since 1966. They've been around for a long time. People might remember that in the winter, we covered the fact that they had voted overwhelmingly to move forward with a BDS resolution vote. And that took place, I believe people sent in their votes electronically from the end of January through mid-March. So as you mentioned, yeah, 80%, 768 to 167 voted in favor of it. On the group's website, the president, Eve Trout Powell, put out a statement where she said, "Our members have cast a clear vote to answer the call for solidarity from Palestinian scholars and students experiencing violations of their right to education and other human rights. Our board will work to honor the will of its members and ensure that the call for an academic boycott is upheld without undermining our commitment to the free exchange of ideas and scholarship." So yeah, pretty notable. As we see more and more of these groups honoring the 2005 call from Palestinians to, you know, for an academic boycott.
You also covered a letter from 50 Democratic members of the House of Representatives sent to Secretary of State Anthony Blinken demanding preventative action on Palestinian home demolitions.
Yeah, that's true. We don't see these every day, of course. 50 House members sent a letter to Secretary of State Blinken, like you said, calling on the Biden administration to intervene. 38 Palestinian homes on the verge of being destroyed. There's some interesting names on this list, I thought, not people that you, they're Mark Pocan, some people that maybe are associated with this issue sometimes, but people like David Price from North Carolina, Jamie Raskin from Maryland. So I thought it was pretty interesting. There's some interesting names on there. I could just read one small part here. It says, in 1949, as part of the armistice, this is from the letter, in 1949, as part of the armistice agreement between Israel and Jordan, residents who had resided in what became Israel were compelled to relocate to the Jordanian side of the Green Line. Israel captured this land in the 1967 war, and after occupying the West Bank, annexed roughly one third of it. So that's pretty notable. We've seen more of these letters in recent years. It's an interesting it's an interesting development, certainly. We'll see if the Biden administration does anything in that regard, although it's very doubtful, obviously, based on their track record.
And lastly, there is more news about Jamal Bowman, the Democrat and squad member from New York, voting to support Iron Dome funding. Can you help us understand what's going on with Jamal Bowman?
I don't think I can personally. I mean, we talked a bit at the site about the fallout involving his membership in DSA, which has kind of spun in all kinds of additional directions now that the BDS working group was dechartered by DSA. We have multiple pieces on our site if people want to check them out. I'll try not to get into the weeds with that, but I would just say that the Iron Dome funding, the vote on Iron Dome funding that happened last year for that extra billion, people might remember that was one of the major sticking points with the backlash to Bowman with DSA. The other one was the trip he took to Israel and Palestine with J Street, the liberal Zionist group. Bowman was one of the only House members to vote against the increased militarization and incarceration spending in that last appropriation spending bill, which just passed, I believe, last week, if not the week before. He put out a statement, though, that made it clear that he would have voted for the Iron Dome funding if it had been cleaved from the rest of the bill. So he put out the statement, and also he would have voted for military aid to Ukraine. So he put out a statement where he said, there were elements of the defense spending section that if voted on separately, I would have supported, including additional military aid to Ukraine and funding for the Iron Dome, which I have already voted for once and I fully support. And then he just goes on to say that the defense and incarceration package is bloated, that we have to cut back on military spending. But I thought that was pretty notable because I'm not really sure what the function was other than to go out of his way to point out, to remind everybody that he supports Iron Dome funding and signal that his vote against that part of the budget, which was obviously a good vote, was not done for anything to do with Israel or Palestine, certainly.
Do you think his vote here is a bit of pre-election positioning?
I mean, it could be, but remember, Bowman just got redistricted too in a situation where it seems like he took his name off or dropped his support of that bill endorsing the Abraham Accords recently. And a lot of people said that they thought the reason he did that is because his district had shifted and he was able to kind of make these decisions now that he didn't have as many pro-Israel constituents. So I'm not sure. I mean, it could just be something to point to maybe in his reelection campaign. But I believe Bowman, if I have this correctly, he had that one Democratic challenger that didn't seem very challenging. And I believe that guy just ended his campaign like a week ago, right? So I'm not sure who he's really, obviously a very heavily Democratic district. There's no chance of a Republican candidate winning. So I'm not entirely sure what his motivations were.
If you're interested in keeping up to date with the changing landscape of U.S. politics around Palestine, visit our site to subscribe to Michael's weekly newsletter, The Shift. It's free to subscribe and it's published every Thursday afternoon. Next, we're going to hear an interview with Michael did with Zoha Khalili, a staff attorney at Palestine Legal, about their 2021 Gear in Review report.
Okay, so to start, in the recent report from Palestine Legal, it says there was a 31% increase of incidents responded to from 2020, an increase from 2020, and a 13% increase from pre-pandemic numbers in 2019. I was wondering what you attribute those increases to. Some of them obviously stem from the pandemic, but what would you attribute to those to beyond the pandemic, potentially?
I mean, it's hard for me to know for sure, but I imagine that there's a variety of factors that are coming into play here. So one of them, I think, is just the egregiousness of the actions of the Israeli government. The evictions in Sheikh Jarrah and the attacks on Gaza that took place in the spring of 2020, I think really resulted in a lot of mobilization and a lot of people coming into the movement. because they're taking place, you know, in the era of social media. There's been live on the ground reporting about what's going on, and I think it's resulting in a lot of people becoming more aware and really getting engaged in activism. And as there are more people engaging in activism, there are more people signing on to solidarity statements, you know, speaking out about Palestine. We're seeing more attacks on them because the Israeli government and its allies are really getting desperate to try to, you know, stem the growth of public awareness in the sphere. The other thing which is related to the pandemic is that in 2020, a lot of the activism was taking place online, and, you know, people were having maybe smaller scale, more private events where they're less likely to face backlash and where there aren't the same gatekeepers like universities controlling whether or not they can have events. But these are really taking place in more private spaces and resulting in a lot of education that is taking place in more like sympathetic spaces. And as these people are getting educated and now, you know, back to being able to have events in person, I think we're seeing just a serious growth in Palestine activism on and off campus. And I, you know, it's still early in March, and so I'm not sure how Israeli Awareness Week is going to be going on campus this year, but I am expecting there to be a huge increase in just the number of events that people are holding and in the turnout to those events, but we'll see.
There was at least 34 legislative attempts to silence Palestinian rights in 2021, you know, obviously anti-BDS laws throughout the country. I thought it was notable that only four passed, according to the report. There's a lot of coverage of these attempts to kind of stifle dissent and silence Palestinian rights. But I was wondering if you could talk maybe a little bit about the resistance to these kinds of measures and laws and what strategies you found have been effective at actually combating them.
Yeah, I think one thing that I found really interesting, there was this new documentary that came out called Boycott, talking about these laws. And there is a scene where the filmmaker is talking to a legislator, and it's a Democratic legislator who says something about how, you know, if he knew what these laws were about, he never would have voted for it in the first place. And I think really the most effective thing people can do is to show up to hearings on these laws and to talk about what the laws actually say. Because I think that with a lot of the legislators that are voting for them, and you see, like, you know, broad bipartisan support for some of these measures, they don't know what they're voting for. And they might think, you know, they stand with Israel, and they don't really realize that they are making an exception for Israel that, you know, we never would make for even the United States. Like, there aren't laws that say that you can't boycott the United States. And I imagine that these legislators, like, would be a lot more loyal to the United States if given the option of choosing whether there needs to be a law that protects the United States from boycotts versus a law that protects Israel from boycotts. But they just, you know, they hear BDS, and that in their minds sounds like something nefarious, because it's been portrayed as something nefarious by Israel's PR machine. But I think just letting people know what BDS is about and explaining and, you know, building alliances with, you know, potential partners in these spaces. So the ACLU has been really effective in elucidating the free speech impacts and the unconstitutionality of these laws and challenging them in court. And I think that, you know, even though they are unwilling to take a stance on Palestine, that building partnerships with these free speech groups in these, like, strategic spaces, I think, has also been very effective, because I think a lot of the legislators don't want to be seen as running afoul of the Constitution and of, like, the way it's being interpreted by the ACLU.
Most of these reported incidents occur on campuses, and, you know, there's been an amazing amount of coverage and discourse and debate about what's called campus free speech in the mainstream. But I'm struck by kind of the disconnect here between mainstream analysis of this phenomenon and what's actually happening to, you know, the opinions of Palestinians or, you know, advocacy for Palestine. It seems that Palestinians who are censored or losing their jobs on campuses, that those kind of stories don't really permeate all these debates about cancel culture or what's called cancel culture. Can you talk a little bit about that disconnect and just that state of affairs, the fact that these things don't really ever enter that discourse, despite the fact that there's so much of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just like fundamental to the idea of mainstream coverage of cancel culture. I think it's just like really self-contradictory of the idea that like you're being canceled, but then you're also publishing an opinion piece in the largest newspaper in the country talking about the way that you're being silenced and that you're afraid to speak out on campus. And I think it's just a lot of times we're seeing, you know, the right wing adopt a lot of language and really weaponize a lot of language that has been used to try to describe the way that that progressives and activists are being targeted and to really try to portray themselves as being the victims. And I think there is a fundamental disconnect between this idea of people being able to speak out and not being restricted by the people in power. So like the First Amendment is meant to prevent the government from restricting our speech. And we have like similar principles where we expect that, for example, Facebook will not be censoring people when it is acting as this public space where people are engaging in most of their discourse. Or other social media companies, I guess maybe Facebook is not that right now. But I think, you know, we have this expectation that that people in positions of authority will not be silencing dissent. And that's like a really fundamental principle for our society. But I think people tend to confuse that with not facing consequences for your actions. And so, you know, when people are saying things that are racist, oftentimes people will, you know, respond to that and say that, for example, they don't want racist professors on campus. They don't want professors that are going to say things that will marginalize like particular students in class. And they don't want their classmates to be saying things that are racist. And, you know, having those consequences from their peers, I think, is something that is beneficial. Like, we want our people to face accountability in society. And that's something that, you know, is being portrayed as cancel culture. And so you then see the people in power who then identify with the racism that those individuals are engaging in, saying like, it's unfair that this, you know, white man is not being allowed to say racist things. And really, you know, because they identify with that, then they will amplify those voices. But you're not seeing people who are having their words manipulated by people who have more power. So students who, you know, might be talking about their family members having their homes destroyed, and then a site like Canary Mission will then say, you know, the homes that were destroyed, they were affiliated with Hamas somehow. And so the student who now is talking about homes being destroyed is defending Hamas. And so we're going to call them terrorists. And then whenever you type their name into Google, the first thing that comes up is this person is supporting terrorists. And that can be devastating for people who are struggling to find a job and whose employers like first see that listed as like, you know, this name associated with terrorists. And, you know, they have like oftentimes like people who are Arab Muslim immigrants active in the movement will have like fairly unique names. And so Canary Mission is really able to effectively target them. And, you know, that causes people to be afraid to engage in activism and really impacts the movement. But I think, you know, when you are literally being canceled, you're a lot less able to talk about that and a lot less able to get that mainstream attention to that issue. It's something that we're trying to draw more attention to. I imagine it's something that Mondo Weiss is trying to draw more attention to. But, you know, we're not there yet. We don't, I think, have the same audience that something like the New York Times would when they're spreading this message.
In addition to these incidents of censorship, there's also some big legal victories that are cited throughout the report, particularly these harassing lawsuits that were filed, which ended up being dismissed. Can you talk about the idea of harassing lawsuits that people maybe don't know what those are, and maybe mention some of those cases briefly?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, the legal victories, because our whole legal system essentially is designed to entrench people who are in power and to preserve that power. And the idea that, you know, even when these pro-Israel groups are trying to use these mechanisms that were designed to, you know, serve the interests of people that are aligned with them, they still fail is just, it's very exciting for me to see as an attorney. And so This is an issue that is broader than Palestine. Oftentimes, you know, people who have the time and the money to go to court to silence people can be effective in, you know, exhausting activists who are trying to speak out on a wide variety of issues. And it's something that is so widespread that there's been a lot of laws that have been passed in, I think, about half of states that create mechanisms for people to throw out lawsuits. Because, you know, you don't have to have an effective legal claim in order to go to court. You essentially just need to have the time and the money to file the papers. And if someone doesn't respond to you going to court, you might, the person that you're suing might lose by default. And so some activist who doesn't have an attorney to respond and or who can't afford to hire someone to respond to a lawsuit, you know, might lose on a case, even though there is absolutely no merit to it. And so in these cases that we talk about in our report, these have been people who did find attorneys who were able to represent them and were able to, you know, defeat these lawsuits that were making absolutely baseless claims. And so one of them that was in California was an activist whose name is Suhaira Nafal, and she had posted something on Facebook, a photo, like a promotional photo that the Israeli Defense Forces had used of one of their soldiers. And she had posted that alongside Palestinian medic. I think Razan, what is her name? Razan al-Najjar. And so Razan had been killed during the Great Return March and while she was providing medical services. And I think Suhaira was just trying to highlight the contrast between, you know, what young Palestinians are doing in defending their people and what young Americans are doing in going to Israel to try to wage these offensive battles. The Israeli soldier, or I guess ex-soldier now, no longer serving in the military, filed a lawsuit in California saying that Suhaira had accused her of personally killing this Palestinian medic. And you know, Suhaira was able to find an attorney who represented her and pushed back and used these laws that have been enacted to try to help people fight back against these harassing lawsuits. And what that law meant was that really early on in the case, Suhaira was able to file papers saying that this is absolutely baseless and not only get the case thrown out without taking too much of her time, but also get her attorney fees paid for. And so the court approved, I think, nearly 50,000 in attorney fees for her attorney. So that, you know, the lawsuit didn't end up costing Suhaira money, assuming that the person who sued her ends up paying up. I'm not sure if that has happened, but and then another case, which actually is still ongoing because the group that lost has filed an appeal. And so the appeal is still pending. This was a much broader issue. It was a lawsuit by the Jewish National Fund against the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. And they were essentially arguing that because the U.S. campaign has spoken out in support of the Great March of Return and has engaged in advocacy in support of that, that they are responsible for kites that were lit on fire and released from Gaza and had landed in forests that were planted by the Jewish National Fund to, you know, cover up Palestinian villages that were destroyed by Israel in its founding, you know, using non-native trees that are incredibly flammable. But there had been some fires that apparently, according to this lawsuit, had resulted from the Great March of Return, and somehow they wanted to accuse the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights of engaging in terrorism for somehow being connected with these fires. The court found these claims absolutely baseless and threw them out, but the Jewish National Fund is still pushing and has appealed to like the next highest court to try to get their lawsuit reinstated. And then there was a lawsuit. And one thing I should note is that amazing attorneys that are working on these lawsuits, not Palestine Legal, so we're not trying to take credit for their work. There was a lawsuit that we were involved in, and this one was on behalf of a group of anonymous presenters who spoke at the 2018 National Students for Justice in Palestine conference. And, you know, because of the surveillance that the host university was engaging in, demanding that the students turn over the names of all of the speakers so that, you know, this was at the University of California, Los Angeles, so that UCLA's police can then check to see if these people are terrorists or threats, which, you know, I don't think speakers in workshops at other conferences have been required to do based off my conversations with students. But there was this intense scrutiny of the conference and, you know, claims that the conference was promoting terrorism and anti-Semitism. And so, you know, the security forces within the university collected a lot of information about the conference. And then a right-wing Zionist attorney said, you know, I want access to that information, even though the conference was closed and, you know, people took a lot of steps to ensure that it was a safe space that people felt comfortable participating in and, you know, didn't think that they would have necessarily their names and information leaked as a result of that conference. So UCLA, because students had actually talked to them about these threats in advance, they understood that they should not be turning over that information to the Zionist attorney, which he was trying to pursue under California's public records laws. So we have laws that try to ensure government transparency. And if you're asking for records from a public institution like the University of California, generally speaking, they would have to turn over those records unless there's some kind of exception. But here, UCLA understood that there is an exception in a situation where, you know, student privacy is at risk. And so they didn't turn over the records. The right-wing Zionist attorney tried to sue them, and we intervened and working on the same side as UCLA to try to protect the privacy of the students and activists that spoke at the conference. And we were successful in preventing the court from forcing UCLA to turn over those records.
And finally, one of the biggest stories of 2021, certainly the biggest activist story at our site, was Ben & Jerry's announcing they were going to stop their business in illegal settlements in Palestine. I should point out before I ask this question that that hasn't actually happened. And they've made it clear that they're not pulling out of Israel entirely. They announced the other day that they're kind of recalibrating their relationship, and activists are continuing to demand that they pull out altogether. But having said that, that decision nonetheless led to a wave of hysterical backlash, but also, you know, governors divesting from their parent company, Unilever, legal maneuvering, lawsuits. I'm just wondering what you make of this from your perspective at Palestine Legal, and what should people be paying attention to as they follow this story over the coming months?
Yeah, I mean, I think you pointed out the most important thing, which is to actually watch and see whether Ben & Jerry's does what they claimed. So it does seem like, you know, if Ben & Jerry's wants to draw a line between illegal settlements and the rest of the occupation of Palestinian lands, that is unlikely to be successful under Israeli law, that, you know, Israel has a big commitment to treating these illegal settlements as part of Israel itself and preventing companies from being able to operate within Israel without operating within illegal settlements. And so I think it's just one thing is that, you know, there is a victory that activists won, but I think there's going to be more work to do to ensure that that victory actually has an impact on the ground. You know, with the large number of states that tried to invoke their anti-boycott laws to punish Ben & Jerry's and Unilever, it was interesting to see that actually there are states whose laws just had no applicability here, and now they're trying to amend their laws to actually get them to apply to Unilever. And I'm curious to see how that plays out, especially because of all the boycotts that are now taking place against Ukraine. And it's been something that we've seen a lot of people highlight, that the hypocrisy of, you know, engaging in a cultural boycott of Russia and not, you know, the same people maybe that are engaging in that boycott and pushing for that boycott are trying to treat a boycott of Israel as being something dangerous and harmful. And so I think it's just really interesting to look at the ways that pro-Israel groups have been trying to portray just like the fluctuations in the market and, you know, Unilever's decisions around corporate restructuring as being somehow driven by this, even though it's really, I imagine, just a drop in the bucket of Unilever's revenues. And so I think it's, I think just it really requires a long-term perspective on how this plays out. I do think it is very chilling for other companies and maybe might make them less susceptible to living up to their social justice values, just to see the huge amount of backlash that Ben and Jerry's and Unilever have faced. But I do think that, I lost my train of thought there. One thing that I think would be really interesting to see is, you know, if these laws, and particularly, I think a lot of the laws that are being invoked here are not the same laws that have been challenged in court. So there is a branch of anti-boycott laws that, you know, require people who are entering into contracts with the state to pledge that they're not going to boycott Israel. But there is a whole other branch of laws that have to do with the companies that states are investing in. And those are the ones that are primarily being invoked here, to say that, like, state pension funds, for example, shouldn't be invested in Unilever. Those laws really haven't been challenged in court because there haven't been people who have been, you know, directly impacted by them. And so, you know, there's one possibility that Unilever absolutely won't be impacted by these divestments because of the way that markets work, and other people might want to invest in Unilever because of, you know, the broad range of products it makes and the profits that it's bringing in as a result of that. But, you know, if it does have a material impact that can be traced to these divestments, Unilever would then be potentially in a position to challenge these laws. And, you know, we because we've never seen that happen, I think it would be really interesting to potentially might result in these anti-boycott laws and this strategy that not only is impacting people who support Palestinian rights, but is impacting a broad range of other social movements because they're serving as a model for example, states are considering now laws against investing in companies that divest from weapons manufacturers, for example, or oil and gas companies. And so it could, you know, the fact that Ben and Jerry's did this could potentially be a test case that results in all of these laws getting overturned if there is a will on the part of Unilever to push back on these moves, and if there is a material impact that takes place in terms of their bottom line, which again is really unclear. I think it's the insane fluctuations of the markets, especially right now. I think it's really impossible to know, but I think that from a long-term perspective, it might be easier to tell.
Well, thanks so much for chatting with us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to talk.
Thanks for listening to our show, a production of MondoWeiss.net. The music is from Sound of Picture. Visit our site to sign up for free daily and weekly newsletters on Palestine, Israel, and related U.S. politics. If you're enjoying our podcast, please consider becoming a donor by visiting MondoWeiss.net/donate. MondoWeiss is a nonprofit publication, and every donation of any amount helps sustain our work. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen, and please leave a rating and review to help other listeners find our show.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Butu. For several decades, Israeli settlers have waged a house-by-house battle in the area of Sheikh Jarrah, attempting to take over Palestinian houses in order to make way for Israeli settlers to live in these Palestinian homes. Over the years, Israel has used a number of different legal techniques to expel Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem. In an attempt to provide a legal veneer to this clear policy of expulsion and ethnic cleansing. In today's episode, we hear from Fatma Salem, matriarch to the Salem family. Fatma is a mother to 8 children, grandmother to 25. Her 3 sons, Ayub, Ibrahim, and Khalil, and their families live with her in Sheikh Jarrah. 3 generations in one house.
My name is Fatima Ziad Salem. I reside in Sheikh Jarrah, and I was born in this home. My mother and my father had us all here, 5 girls and 3 boys. My sisters all got married. As for my brothers, some went to Amman and others moved to different neighborhoods of Jerusalem, Bab al-Khalil, or the New Gate. My older brother came back from Amman and then moved to the neighborhood of Shofat, and I did not leave this house. I stayed with my mother and father to help them since they were both sick, my dad especially. He was not able to walk or use his legs, so I helped him. My husband was working in a bakery and helped us a lot. He helped my dad often when he wasn't able to move. My husband was from the destroyed village of Colombia. He was a poor man, but he helped my dad. My dad was sick in the hospital for 3 months until he passed away. My mom passed away before him. She's married in Bab al-Asbat Cemetery in Jerusalem. And I remained in this house with my husband and kids. After my father passed away, they came to my house to try and take it. I refused. I told them I was born in this home. I was married in this home. I had my children and grew up in this home. I am not leaving.
This family will be forcibly expelled from their home anytime soon. Protests to save the family have been taking place since the beginning of February, and in order to avoid a repeat of the May 2021 protests, the Israeli police have completely barricaded the area surrounding the Salem home. It's virtually impossible to get in. The Salem family tells me that they haven't had guests in weeks, that the Salem children have stopped working because they fear for the safety of their mother, Fatma, and that her grandchildren are suffering from night terrors. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers and attack dogs are allowed to enter the area freely, with an Israeli MK, Itamar Ben-Gvir, setting up a makeshift parliamentary office. Ben-Gvir is a supporter of Meir Kahane and a man who once claimed that the mass murderer Baruch Goldstein is his hero. The Salem house is small and simple, but with a lovely courtyard in the center filled with fruit trees that were planted by Fatma and her parents.
The trees outside in the garden my dad and I planted. One day, settlers came and cut them. I woke up screaming and crying, "Come see what they did, come see what they did." This was 2 months before my dad passed away. I feel his soul in this house. It used to be abandoned. It was like a cave. There were chickens and pigeons outside, only one big room and a bathroom outside, and we fixed it. It'd be impossible to leave this house, even if they come with 60 different court decisions.
To get to Fatmi's house, we had to climb over a pile of dirt, which was once a lush green garden. The dirt is where Israeli settlers have taken over the neighboring home, and in order to make it difficult for the Salem family to enter, they've dug up the land. Fatma lives in a tiny room, no more than 12 feet by 12 feet. It's a room she built for her parents so they would not have to climb the stairs to their house, and the room where she witnessed her father and husband take their last breaths. Fatma is 71 years old. She has lived in this house for her entire life. Like many of the other families facing expulsion by Israel in the Sheikh Jarrah area, Fatma's family fled Yaffa in 1948 during Israel's ethnic cleansing campaign. Her family found refuge in Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem and, with the approval of the Jordanian government, stayed in the house. Remember, this was an area that was not under Israel's control because it is in East Jerusalem. In 1967, when Israel occupied Jerusalem, Israeli settlers put their sights on that area and pushed for the passage of an Israeli law that permits Jewish Israelis to reclaim properties owned in East Jerusalem before 1948. Israeli settlers then began claiming that the Salem house had previously been owned by a Jewish family and sought the expulsion of the Salem family. This same law that allows heirs of pre-1948 Jewish-owned properties to claim their property back does not apply to the pre-1948 Palestinian Christian and Muslim-owned properties. To be clear, it is not the heirs of the property that are seeking the expulsion of the Saddam family, but rather an Israeli settler NGO. In fact, it's unclear whether the property was ever Jewish-owned. It is an Israeli settler NGO alongside Yonatan Yosef, who seeks the expulsion of the Salem family. Yosef is the grandson of the late Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, Shas's spiritual leader. He is known for stating that, quote, Goyim, non-Jews, were only born to serve us, Jews, and when referring to Palestinians, that, quote, it is forbidden to be merciful to them. You must send missiles to them and annihilate them. They are evil and damnable. Unquote. But this isn't just the act of one Israeli settler or one Israeli settler group, but the state of Israel itself. The expulsion notice was hand-delivered to Fatmi by Yosef and by the deputy mayor of Jerusalem, Aryeh King. Yes, the deputy mayor of Jerusalem hand-delivered the expulsion notice to Fatmi Salem.
Yosef al-Abadi came alleging that he bought the rights to my home. Him and Ari came. He knocked on our door. I opened it, and they said, you have to leave the house. I said, why? He said, because I bought this house, and you have to leave. He showed me some papers. I still have them. I show journalists them whenever they come to see me. And I told him to leave and said, this is my house. I've lived here my whole life and will continue to live here.
The Saddam family is one of 217 families in Jerusalem facing expulsion from their homes. For now, the court has decided to freeze, but not stop, the expulsion of the Saddam family. If they pay a deposit, the equivalent of $12,000. Settlers have vowed to appeal the decision to freeze the Saddam family's expulsion. And as the round-the-clock protests continue, the Salem family is hoping that something, anything, will stop their expulsion and stop the settlers. Fatma Salem herself has vowed to remain.
I am not afraid of them. If I told you I was afraid of them, I'd be lying. I stand with all my strength and I face them and look into their eyes and they stare at me and try to intimidate me. I am not afraid of them. Why should I be? They are the aggressors, not me. They are the ones coming to take our homes and our land.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. Please don't forget to subscribe. I'm Deanna Butu. Thanks for listening. محل بعيد ما رح ينفع للبكي ولا التهديد راح الحب راح محل بعيد صار لازم نبلش من جديد راح الحب راح مطرح تاني تنقل قلب في لحظة ينساني وعلى شو عم ببكي وزعلاني ما كان بده يروح بس راح ما كان بده يروح بس راح ما كان بده يروح بس راح الحب مش باقي له في شي انتهى في شي خلص انكسر راح الحب مش باقي له أثر ضحكتنا بدو يعيد النظر ما كان بدو يروح بس راح ما كان بدو يروح بس راح ما كان بدو يروح بس
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
This piano piece may well sound ordinary to you until you realize that it was taught to young Chloe just last week by Janet, who's still teaching at 81. Seniors bring so much to Quebec. Let's recognize their contribution. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
We're going to call you CKUT. You've got this frequency, 98.3. That frequency is what you're picking up when you tune that radio.
Very impressive.
You can sit on the moon and we'll talk to pick up CKUT, clear as a bell.
fascinating.
Your analysis seems logical.
CKUT, CKUT, CKUT. CKUT is on the air.